That's my opinion. Other people have other opinions.
Okay, both sides. We have a photocopy page. Yeah, I don't know. I'll leave it on my desk because we'll see if we'll get to it today. I hope we will. And that's the astronomy part of this this discussion. So we're now on Daf Yud Aleph Amud Aleph. And the last thing we discussed was at the end of the period of the Nevuah, there were still individuals, rare as they were, who were capable, were worthy of prophecy. But because of the nature of the dar of that generation, they were not zochah to prophecy, but they did have some sort of ruach hakodesh, not exactly prophecy, in which they were able to foresee events that would happen down the line. So the Gemara talks about Hillel. Hillel becomes, in the post-prophetic period, he becomes the paradigm of a prophet who unfortunately was not able to receive prophecy. But when they eulogized him after his death, they said about him something which was very, very unique, and that is, Hey Chassid, Hey Anav Talmido Shel Ezra. In other words, that Hillel would be the personification of these two character traits. He, on the one hand, is a chassid, he's very pious, and dedicated to the mitzvahs in a meticulous way. And on the other hand, he's also an anav, he's very humble. In fact, many of the discussions in Shas about humility revolve around the personality of Hillel. He was really the personification of anava, of humility. That's what he embodied in his very essence, in his very personality. Anava is critical as far as prophecy is concerned. In fact, who would be the greatest prophet of all time and the greatest humble person of all time? Moshe Rabbeinu, correct. Moshe Rabbeinu is described as Lokam Navi Od the Yisrael Kamoshe, and also the Pasuk says about Moshe Rabbeinu that he's the Anav Mikol Adam. So we see that humility and prophecy are interdependent. And the Rambam, in his famous work called the Shmona Prakim, he dedicates an entire chapter to Nevuah, to prophecy, and he discusses who is worthy of prophecy, and he speaks and focuses almost exclusively on the Mida, the personality trait of humility. And in that sense, man is called upon to imitate God. God is considered the embodiment of anava. Kol makom shata motzei gedula. So wherever you find the greatness of God, you also find his anava. And that's why God shares everything with man, and he creates man. And the Rambam explains that this is Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu is the epitome of anava. The Marsha here, in his commentary on our Gemara, explains that Hillel HaZaken would be the person who, although he's not mentioned by name, but the person who's hinted at by this Baskol, that the Baskol says that there's someone here who's Roy Shetishra Olav Shechina. And although the Baskol didn't point a finger and identify anyone, didn't single out anyone by name, the Chacham understood that the Baskol was referring to none other than Hillel. Now it's also interesting, the Marsha points out, that both Moshe Rabbeinu and Hillel HaZaken lived to the ripe old age of 120. And not only that, out of their each respectively had 120 years to live, each of them was Manig B'Yisrael, was the leader of Israel for a period of 40 years. And the third equation between Moshe and Hillel, besides which, as we said before, they were both worthy of Shechina, of prophecy, of Anova. They both led the people of Israel for one third of their lives, for 40 years out of 120. But in addition to that, the great midah of Anova of Hillel was in a sense an embodiment of that Anova, of that humility of Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, we should mention two points here. Number one, we have Shmuel HaZaken. Shmuel HaZaken is also an embodiment of Anova. We didn't get to Shmuel HaZaken yet, but he's not considered like Moshe Rabbeinu because the Maharsha points out that he doesn't have the similarities that Hillel has to Moshe Rabbeinu in terms of the Anova of Hillel, in terms of the amount of years that he lived, in terms of the amount of years that he led the people of Israel. All this is a very unique combination or connection between Hillel and Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, you may see in your Gemara, in parentheses, following the statement of Yeshkan Echad Sharoi Shetishal of Shechina, you may see Kim Moshe Rabbeinu. Do you have that?
Mm-hmm.
How many lines down is it from the top? I would say, well, actually, count up from the bottom. It's literally halfway up. Anyway, you'll see the first two words in the line that are put in parentheses are Kim Moshe Rabbeinu. And the Marshal, who is a contemporary of the Marshal, his name is Luria, he objected to the words Kim Moshe Rabbeinu because how can you compare anyone's Hashras HaShechina and anyone's prophecy to Moshe Rabbeinu? It's impossible. You can never qualify, even in quantitative, but in qualitative terms, Lo kol navi od ki Moshe v'Yisrael. But yet the Rambam apparently had this gear, so the Marsha defends the Rambam that it's Kim Moshe Rabbeinu because of the striking similarities between Hillel and Moshe Rabbeinu. That the Baskol says about Hillel that Roy Shetishal of Shechina, that Hillel, who lived again, as we said before, to the age of 120 like Moshe, and he led the people of Israel for 40 years. He was the Rosh Hashiva and the Nasi for 40 years. His Anova was outstanding, like the Midah of Moshe Rabbeinu. So then, although obviously Hillel is not on the level of Moshe Rabbeinu, Lo kam Navi od b'Yisrael k'Moshe, but nevertheless, the similarities are so striking that we can justify the gears of that text that we have here, which says Kim Moshe Rabbeinu, and the Ashras HaShechina of Hillel is a result of this Chasidus and Anova. Those two midos together, that really is an very very powerful combination of both Chasidus and Anova. That's going to lead to Ruach HaKodesh, and this is based on a sugya called Rabbi Pinchas ben Yoyer. Does anybody know who wrote a book based on that sugya in Avodah Zarah Daf Chaf of Pinchas ben Yoyer, who wrote an entire famous work, perhaps one of the most famous works in the history of Musar, the Lutzato, right? That's called the Mesilat Yesharim. I think it's translated as the Path of the Just, correct? And in the Mesilat Yesharim, the Ramchal writes about the various levels that lead up to Ruach HaKodesh. You know, you have to go from one level, one stage to the other. It's all based on the Brisa of Pinchas ben Yoyer. And if you take a look in the Brisa, you'll see that the emphasis is on Chasidus and Anova, on those two character traits. Those are the keys. So if there's anyone here in this room who really wants to be a prophet, and you're applying as a candidate for prophet school, they give a master's degree if you pass, and then the two midos that you want to focus your attention on are the midos of Chasidus and Anova. Now, if you want to know what Chasidus is and what Anova is, you're going to have to learn the Mesilas Yesharim. But we have a translation here into English, so it's very accessible. Now, you may get the misimpression here from this Gemara that Ezra was the Rebbe of Hillel, because it says about Hillel he was Talmido Shel Ezra. Well, that's not possible, because in fact Ezra lived at the time of the building of the second bias. Hillel lived way into the building, into the second bias period of time. So when it says that Hillel is a Talmud of Ezra, it means that he has certain similarities to Ezra. Because Chazal say about Ezra that he came to Eretz Yisrael from Bavel, and the phrase that Chazal uses, Talmudo Biyado. Talmudo Biyado means Ezra had acquired a great deal of Torah scholarship in Bavel, and he brought that with him to Eretz Yisrael, and he developed a higher level of scholarship in Eretz Yisrael, and that's based on the principle of Ein Torah Kitoris Eretz Yisrael, that's derived by Chazal and Medrashim from the Pasuk Zahav Haaretz Ahito. And Hillel likewise imitated Ezra. Now, it turns out that the Ben Ish Chai claims, that's a sefer called Ben Yehoyada, which we have here in the library, that Hillel lamad mimidoso shel Ezra Sofer, that Hillel learned from the midos of Ezra, he tried to emulate Ezra. Sheshimesh harbe es rabo baruch ben Neria, velo olo li eretz yisrael kol zman shayiv baruch ben Neria kayam. Now, this is very interesting. Ezra Sofer delayed his aliyah to Eretz Yisrael and the entire process of the building of the second Mikdash. Now, what inhibited Ezra? You know, the Nefesh B'Nefesh had a flight at the beginning of the year, but he didn't take that flight. He waited a full year. Why? And the answer is because he's Meshamish his Rebbe, who is known as Baruch Ben Neria. And as long as Baruch Ben Neria was alive, and Ezra had the opportunity to learn from him, he did not make Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael. And I remember when my wife and I, shortly after we got married, we were making Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael. I said, it's a shame that I can't bring my Rebbe with me. You know, to leave my Rebbe behind, that was a very difficult chapter of my life.
Why not?
Because you want to connect with your Rebbe. I mean, any question that I had in life, I wanted to ask my Rebbe. The only question that I didn't ask him is whether to make Aliyah or not. Because I was afraid he was going to tell me not to make Aliyah. So what I did was, I just came in and I told Rebbe, I got a job in Malad Dumim. I don't know if anybody knows where that is.
Sorry.
You've been there? So when I was in Malad Dumim, there was no city at all, whatsoever. It was just a yeshiva out there, and it was 5 kilometers closer to Yerushalayim. Closer to Yericho, excuse me. And I told the Rebbe that I got a job offer in Malad Dumim, and that's where I want to go. So immediately he tells me to bring me a Gemara Rosh Hashanah. So he had a small shas there in the morgue. I don't know if anybody knew where the Rav used to live. And I brought him a Gemara Rosh Hashanah. He shows me where the name Malad Dumim comes from. Because Gemara Rosh Hashanah says that when they wanted to publicize the new moon after the Adam came in and Bezin declared the new month, so what they did was they would Masiyah Masos, they would raise torches from one mountaintop to the other, and that was in a place called Malad Dumim. Anyway, so that's what we say about Ezra. Ezra did not want to make Aliyah because he didn't want to leave behind his Rebbe Baruch Ben Neria. Okay then? Now, in the case of Hillel, we find something very, very similar. Does anybody know who the Rebbeim of Hillel was? Were. He had 2 Rebbeim. They were not Jewish by birth. Anybody know who I'm referring to? No? Shmaya Vavtalion. Did you ever hear of them?
Yeah.
Shmaya Vavtalion were part of the Chachmei HaMesorah, and they transmitted the Torah to Hillel HaZaken. Again, don't mistake, there's a Hillel that came later on, it's called Hillel HaSheni, but we're talking about the original Hillel. And he was Meshamesh, Hillel was Meshamesh, his 2 Reveim, Shmaya Vavtalion, B'Mesiris Nefesh, and he delayed his coming to Eretz Yisrael until he could no longer learn from Shmaya Vavtalion. That's very fascinating because at the beginning of Masechta Sanhedrin, the Rabbeinu Chananel has a discussion about the status of Shmaya Vavtalion as judges, because it seems that they sat on the Bezin HaGadol, but a ger is not officially allowed to make any decisions of the Bezin HaGadol. It has to be Me'achecha, it has to be from the genealogy. So the Rabbeinu Chananel has a fantastic answer. He says that Shmaya Vavtalion took part in all the deliberations of the courts, and they were the most influential, and they had a powerful influence on the judges. But when it came to Amida Laminyan, the actual vote, then 2 other judges had to replace Shmaya Vavtalion. But Shmaya Vavtalion really were the most powerful, towering personalities in the Bezin HaGadol, in the High Court of Israel. And there's a famous story in the Gemara and Shabbos about Hillel, that initially when Shmaya Vavtalion were giving their lectures in the Beis Medrash, you had to pay a certain fee to get into the Beis Medrash. Rabbi Weiss would be happy about that. So Hillel was so poor, he was poor as a church mouse, he didn't have enough money to get into the Beis Medrash. So you remember the story?
Yeah,
he climbs up to the roof, and then there was a snowstorm. And in the morning, when Shmaya Vavtalion looked up at the roof, they saw that there was a shadow coming from the roof. then they revived him. I mean, he was almost, and all this was because he would put his life into danger to be Meshamesh Shmaya Vavtalion. So the paradigms of Shimush Talmid Chachamim are, on the one hand, Ezra Sofer, within his relationship to his Rebbe Baruch Ben Neria, and in a later generation, Hillel HaZok, in his relationship to his Rebbeim, Shmaya Vavtalion. Who else personifies these two midos of Chassid and Anna? And that's going to be Shmuel HaKatan. The reason he's called HaKatan is not because he was young in age, but because he was Maktinus Atzmo. His humility was such that he lowered his status. He didn't boast about all the knowledge that he had. And once again, there was a baskol, even after the termination of Nevuah with the death of Chagi Zechari Malachi, that declared that to someone here who's Roy, he's fit for the Ashras Ashkina for Nevuah. Again, he can't achieve that Nevuah because of the generation. And the Chachamim pointed to Hillel, to Shmuel HaKatan. And once again, when Shmuel HaKatan passed away, they eulogized him, Hey Chassid, Hey Anav, Talmid Shel Hillel. He is the next generation of Hillel, meaning the next duplicate or replica of Hillel. So that's the Mandiyomer who's called Shmuel HaKatan. And it's interesting because the Yad Ramah says that it's not coincidental that his name was Shmuel, because he was royal in Nevuah Kishmuel HaRamasi. Just like Shmuel was one of the greats of all prophecy of all time, so too Shmuel HaKatan, had he only been allowed, if not for the generation, to reach his fruition in Nevuah, he would have been on the same level of Shmuel HaRamasi, the original Shmuel. And that's because he was both a chassid and an anav. Now, there was a case in which Shmuel HaKatan, before he died, actually prophesied. He foretold the future. And that's the story of the Asar Ruge Malchus. Amongst them was Rabbi Yishmael Kohen Gadol. And he also has, does he have Rabbi Akiva here? Where is that? I lost my listeners. B'shas Misoso. And what does he foretell? He says, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel was the Nasi, and Rabbi Shmuel would both be put to death by Cherev. Does anybody remember? I mean, you were probably there at the time, so you probably remember the discussion that took place between Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Shmuel when they were about to be put to death by sword. Do you remember that discussion? You weren't there? Anyway, the Medrash tells of the discussion that one of them, I think it was Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol, broke out in tears as they were taking him out to be beheaded. And Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, the Nasi, turns to the Kohen Gadol, to Rabbi Shmuel, and he says, "Why are you crying?" He says to him, "You shouldn't be crying, because in another few seconds you'll be in the bosom of the Almighty, you'll be up in Shamayim." So Rabbi Shmuel says, "I'm not crying because I'm afraid of death. I'm crying with the way they're putting us to death, through the sword." And he quotes the parsha in Mishpatim of what's called Inui Almana. Do you remember that? Inui Almana means if you cause anguish to a widow, then the Torah promises that you'll be put to death by sword for Inui Almana. So he says to his colleague Rabbi Shmuel, I don't know how many seconds they had until they perished, but he says to him, why are we being put to death in this particular way? Are we guilty of inui almana? So what I'm about to tell you, I heard from my Rebbe many, many years ago, and it's something that it's like Erev Tisha B'Av, you know, in a day or so will be the month of Av. So we want to introduce the month of Av with the following insight. The Kohen Gadol thought that maybe he was perhaps, or Yishmael, perhaps guilty of Inui Almana. How would that be possible? So the Medrash tells us, Medrash Eicha, that Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel responded to. Does this interest anybody?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. I'm kind of going a little bit off the doubt. But so Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel responded that perhaps there was a situation in which an almana came to ask you a question in halacha, and you postponed it. You were very exhausted and you told her to come back tomorrow. As a result, she cried, she shed a tear. So my Rebbe used to say the following: the great sensitivity that the Torah requires for an almana, for a widow, and it goes beyond the widow, it goes to orphans and other unfortunate people in society, is such that although, strictly speaking, Rabbi Shmuel had every reason to postpone his meeting with this almana. Why? Because it was Rabbi Shmuel who had the responsibility. He was the elective representative of the Jewish people to the Roman government, and this is at the time B'Shmat, and he had come back from a full day of deliberation with the Romans in an attempt to save the Jewish people, and he was exhausted. He had what's called a shamai. Shamai means a what would you call it? A servant. I don't know what word you want to use. You know, in Yiddish they call it a heisbacher. You know, he was in charge of answering the doorbell and setting up appointments. And the doorbell rang, figuratively, right? And this almana shows up and she says, she has a question. Can I speak to Rabbi Shmuel? So the servant tells her that my master is exhausted and he's about to fall off his feet. Can you come tomorrow? And apparently Rabbi Shmuel heard this and he said nothing. And as a result, she shed a tear. So Rav Soloveitchik said the following: why was she so sensitive? Because she felt, and this is the thought that crossed her mind, that had her husband been alive, then in honor of her husband, Rabbi Shmuel would have pushed himself, even at the point of exhaustion, to answer a question. But because her husband is gone, therefore he's able to, again, the Shevi Altas, it was the decision of the servant, but he could have objected. He was able to postpone her for another day. And so she sheds a tear because she realizes in her state of loneliness that because her husband is no longer alive, that's why this happened, and that's why she was pushed off. That's the sensitivity of a sensitive soul, in this case of an almana. The truth is that we're all sensitive, and you don't have to be an almana in order to be sensitive, but an almana is a classic example, and that's how Rabbi Shmuel understood why he was being put to death in that way. It's unbelievable, yisod. Then Shmuel HaKatan prophesizes about Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava and others. Now, after Shmuel dies, just one second, the Akka, here's where we're up to. I think this is the last thing we got up to. The Akan Sgiyin. So let's take a look inside, so everybody's on the same line. You remember the line that starts with Moshe Rabbeinu?
Yeah.
So if you drop below that about five lines, there's a line that starts, no, more than five lines. The Akan Sgiyin, yeah. Right? Akan are sorrows, are sufferings, and Sgiyin are things that happen on a regular basis. Asidin lemeisi al alma. So Shmuel HaKatan, before his death, is predicting that we'll be in a state in which the whole world is going to suffer tsaros merubos, and this is going to take place at the time of the Romans, of the Roman Shmat. And then he goes on to say that the al Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava bikshu lomar kein. Now, what this means is, and here we have to press the return button, because we're really starting a new paragraph, but it's a hemshech, it's a continuation. Shmuel died, and they recited that eulogy, that very special eulogy of Hei Chassid Hei Anav. But in the future, at the time of the Roman persecution, when they put Yehuda ben Bava to death, the people of Israel wanted to give the same hesped that they gave for Shmuel HaKatan and they had previously given for Hillel for Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava. El Nitrifa Hashah, that the hour was not appropriate. It was some sort of a bilbil, a tarot, a mixture, and then everything was confusing. And there was no way that they could have even the composure to recite such a short and sweet eulogy. They just took the body of Yehuda ben Bava and they buried him without any eulogy. And why? The Gemara says this reflects a halachic principle called Ein Maspidim al Haruge Malchus, that anyone who's put to death by the kingdom because he's a Jew, we're not going to eulogize him. Why aren't we going to eulogize him? So Rashi says, because of Yiras HaMelech, we're afraid of the king. Now I mentioned many times that the super commentary amongst the Rishonim on Masechta Sanhedrin is the Yad Ramah. The Yad Ramah offers three interpretations as to what the logic that underlies this principle of Ein Maspidim al Harugei Malchus is. The first one is that we have to bury him without any delay, because it's very possible that the king will change his mind and it will decide that we cannot allow you to bury the dead. Why? Because this was an enemy of the state, right? In this case, Yehuda ben Bava, and who knows what they would do with his body. Halavai, they would cremate his body, but they could do worse things to his body. That's what they did to Rabbi Akiva's body. So the first reason why we're not going to delay even by a second with a short hesped and gather together the people is because we have to take advantage of this moment. It's urgent to bury him. Then the Yad Ramah gives his second explanation. And he says the following, that a hesped is called Kavod Al Mes. And when it comes to Harugei Malchus, it's very dangerous. Why? Because since the king perceives this individual who's put to death as the adversary of the kingdom, no kavod can be given to this Harugei Malchus. If we give kavod, it would be considered and construed as an act of rebellion against the king. And the third explanation offered by the Yad Ramah is that we have to worry about the following. Shema Yomar HaMelech. The Melech might declare, She'elu Maspidim. These people who are giving the hesped, they themselves are really harboring that enmity against the kingdom, and they also have to be put to death. So again, Rabosei, all three explanations of the Yad Ramah really revolve around the same point. The urgency of putting this person into the ground and burying him without delay, whether it's because maybe the king will change his mind, this was an adversary of the king, as the king perceived it, or because it might implicate them that if they're giving such cover to the Harugei Malchus, how can they do such a thing? That itself is a rebellion against the king. And the third permutation of the second is that the king will define them or identify them as adversaries against the king. And maybe the king will see in that hesped a sort of hidden curse against the king himself. Meaning it's not explicit, but that's what the Jews are doing. By lauding and praising the one who was put to death by the king, they're implying a curse against the king. Okay, now we're ready to start the sugya for today. Tana Rabbanan. So let's see if we can find the place here. Tana Rabbanan. Ein Ma'abrim Es Hashanah. Do we have it?
Yes.
It's about 12 lines up from the bottom. Now, Eima Abrimis Hashana Elim Kain Yirtzah Nasi. You remember that we mentioned in the past that the Nasi, who's the head of the highest court in Israel, the Nasi of the Sanhedrin, presides over the high court of 71, and we must get his approval in order to be Ma'abr the Shana. And he has veto power if he wants to exercise his rights to negate the process of Ibur Shana. We're going to discuss this at great length. What is this based upon? Now let's understand that Ibur Shana fundamentally is about the holidays of Israel. What do I mean? The holidays of Israel reflect which calendar? The lunar or the solar calendar?
Solar.
No, the holidays of Israel reflect the lunar calendar. Right. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'll explain. Sure. Don't get upset. Don't get nervous. I mean, but it's really the lunar calendar. The problem is that there are elements in this process of determining the holidays which reflect the solar calendar. What do I mean? Although the date for each holiday is in the lunar calendar, for example, the 15th of Nisan is going to be the date for Pesach, mm-hmm. And the Torah says, Elu Moadi Hashem Asher Tikru Osam. What it means is that in order to guarantee that the 15th of Nisan fall out in a certain season, because the Torah describes Pesach not just in terms of the calendar date, which was the lunar calendar date, but also in terms of the season.
Spring.
The spring, excellent. What's that called in Hebrew?
Aviv.
Aviv, excellent. In terms of Aviv, excellent. You're my man. Okay? So now, we need to somehow have a mirror image between the lunar calendar and the solar calendar. Again, we're going to have a lot to talk about in that, but just if you could accept this as a first premise, that it's not just enough to establish Pesach on the 15th of Nisan, we also have to have it in Chodesh Aviv. Now, Chodesh Aviv is going to be determined by the solar calendar. And now we have a discrepancy between the lunar calendar and the solar calendar. So we can tolerate that for a few years, but after that discrepancy starts sort of like piles up, one on top of the other, you have like a shifting holiday, meaning shifting in terms of the seasons of the year. Again, the date will remain the same. It's always going to be on the 15th of Nisan, but what season will it be in? After a while, when the lunar calendar lags behind the solar calendar by a very significant amount, what you're going to find is that the 15th of Nisan is in a different season. But the main point that I want to emphasize here is Eila Moadi Hashem Asher Tikru Osam, and the Gemara says Tola Kosev Ibur Shadav Bebeznin. So the Tikru Osam means the representative of Klal Yisrael. Klal Yisrael really are in charge of determining the Moadim based on the lunar calendar. But when it says Asher Tikru Osam, who's going to represent Klal Yisrael? No, it's going to be you or me. You know, let's say we get together and we have a consensus exactly when is the first of the month and so forth and so on. No. Who represents Klal Yisrael, Asher Tikru Osam? It's the Beis Din. Which Beis Din? There's only one Beis Din that has the power, the authority to represent all of Klal Yisrael. Which Beis Din is that? The Beis HaGadol, the High Court of Israel. Now, the High Court of Israel is represented by one individual who is the presider over the entire Beis Din, and he's called the Nasi. So we go from A to B to C. A means that the holidays are determined by the lunar calendar. The lunar calendar is given into the hands of Beis Din, and Beis Din here means the Beis Din that represents all of Klal Yisrael, and that means the Beis Din HaGadol. And then we get to the third point, that the Beis Din HaGadol is presided over by the Nasi. So I want to again quote the Yad Ramah. We've been quoting the Yad Ramah very often lately. He says the following, Yesh L'tmoa, Ma Tzorech L'Daito Shel HaNasi. Why do we need the approval of the Nasi? After all, and I share this Ramah with you, Yad Ramah with you as an introduction to the whole sugya, because he says something that's so basic, we should know this in kindergarten already, but the Yad Ramah spells it out, so it's very important that we learn it. He says, why do they need a Nasi? Harei ma'abrim l'fi acheshbon. It's built into the calendar, this Ibur Shana. Why? Sheyiu, the calendar was set up that there should be every 7 years, Sheyiu sheva shanim u'baros, I'm sorry, not every 7 years, but within a period of 19 years, there's always going to have to be 7 out of the 19 years that are pregnant, that have an extra month of Adar. So what's the big deal about the Nasi here? We already have a system which builds it in. Says the Yad Ramah, this is very fundamental. Shebizman shayu bezin kavua b'yeretz Yisrael. During the historical period when we had a court, a high court of Israel, in the land of Israel, then there was no such thing as cheshbon. There were no calculations here. There was no guarantee that every so often we would have to have an Ibur Shana, but everything would depend upon the Beis Din and only on the Beis Din. There was no calendar, and that's called Toli B'das Beis Din. And again, who represents the Das Beis Din, or at least is it critical? That's the Nasi. And then, at that time, Hayu Bodkin B'Simonim HaMuvayim, we're going to have all the Simonim, what were the causes and the reasons for Beis Din to decide. And it's got to be a decision of Beis Din to be ma'abra the shana. The Gemara is going to say on the next daf, the Aviv, Tkufa, Peres Elam, we'll have to go through all these. And therefore, there were many occasions in which there was an absolute need, an urgent need to be ma'abr the shana, and lo ayu ma'abrim, even though there was a need to be ma'abr the shana, what it might cause is a very great loss. And we're going to see that, you know, there are factors going this way and going that way. So, for example, in a drought year where people are hungry, they may postpone the Ibur Shana for whatever reasons, as we'll see. So whenever you talk about a number like 7 out of every 19 years has to be an Ibur Shana, you're talking about a later period in Jewish history, which is after the Churban of Eretz Yisrael, and it was no longer based in Kavua to be Ma'abr the Shana. Then they established, this is what we call Hill Hasheni, not the hill that we've been talking about until now, a cheshbon, and there was a calculation in which the calendar would set up, and it was built into the calendar when they would be ma'abr the shana. And the Yad Ramah concludes his presentation by saying that halacha l'moshe b'sinai shebizman sheyesh bezdin, when there is a bezdin, yavru lefi kviyus bezdin, everything depends upon whether bezdin, when and if and when bezdin will make that decision that it's urgent and we must be ma'abr the shana. However, bizman she'ein bezdin kavu be'eretz Yisrael, then ma'abr mes hashana lefi cheshbon. So we have two historic periods of time. Our Gemara, which is going to address the question of what would make bezdin make that decision that we have to be ma'abr the shana, is addressing the period of bezdin kavu be'eretz Yisrael, the nasi preside over that bezdin. In the case of Rabbi Gamliel, he was the Nasi, and they would make a decision, al das bezdin, representing Klal Yisrael, for the benefit of Klal Yisrael, to be ma'abr the shana. And only then, when that decision was signed and sealed, would there be ibur hashana. What we're familiar with is a period of time after the Churban of Eretz Yisrael, when there was no longer bezdin kavua, and then Hillel Hasheni got up and he was metaken a cheshbon, a calendar. And then we have Ibur Hashana built in to the very calendar of Israel. Now the Gemara tells us about Rabbi Gamliel. Maisa b'Gamliel shaholach litol rishus. Rabbi Gamliel was amongst the people who was the of the few individual leaders who was the liaison of the people of Israel to the Roman government. So he needed to get the permission, the license of the Roman government on some sort of an enterprise that he was instituting and acting for the benefit of the people of Israel. And what exactly did he miss, you know, while he was away? You know, we're not talking about Rabbi Gamliel, who was on an AACI trip to the Finland, you know, for a month. That's a good way of promoting Aliyah, right? Okay. Anyway. I find it very paradoxical. You know, a guy said, I hadn't seen him in a month. He says, I said, where were you? He was with the AACI. So I figured if he was in the AACI, he was probably up in, you know, in the Golan or something. He was in Finland for a month. You know, watching, visiting the fjord. What do they call the fjords? How do you say it in English?
Fjord. What's fjord?
I don't know exactly what they are because I've never been to Finland.
The river.
Okay, that's a good way of encouraging Aliyah. Okay, fine.
It's the Surya, not Roman.
However, it is in the same time zone.
Okay, that's good. So what happened in the absence of Rabbi Gamliel? So where was Rabbi Gamliel? He wasn't to be found. He was Eitzel HaShilton Echad Shebesuria and V'sham Milavo. Again, it's like Moshe Rabbeinu. You know, when is he coming down the mountain? In the meantime, the Bezdin thought that there was a critical, urgent need to be Ma'abr the Shana. Again, the reasons for that we'll learn in our sugya. The Ibrus HaShana. But now we have to understand that this was not an act of audacity, but rather this was a conditional Ibur Shana. And that's called in the language of Shas Almanas. Whenever you see those two words, Almanas, it means on the condition of. And what was the built-in condition? I mean, we learned from this Gemara that you could have a basis of making a decision of Ibur Shana on a condition. And the condition was, exactly, that when Rav Gamliel would return, Sheyirtzer Rav Gamliel, he would nod his head in approval. Ukshavar Rav Gamliel v'Amar, he declared, Rotzani, I'm very happy about this Ibur. And Nimtzeis HaShana Me'uberes. Therefore the Shana is the decision of the Beis Din is valid. But it only became valid when? When Rabbi Gamliel proved. Now this is very similar to a Gemara Kiddushin about marriage. A man says to a woman, I'm going to marry you al-Manas on the Kiddush Sheyirtzer Ava. you know, the father's away, and he wants to have his daughter's hand in marriage. He can't ask the father. They didn't have, you know, Skype or whatever in those days. So what happens is that the marriage is sort of up in the air. Because almanas means that the marriage is valid now, but the condition has to be fulfilled. Now, if the condition is not fulfilled, that the father comes back and he says, I don't want this love as my son-in-law, then the entire marriage is completely null and void. She doesn't need a get or anything. On the other hand, when he approves, then the marriage is valid l'mafreya retroactively from the time that he gave her kesef shtar abir, because this is a tanai of almanas. There's another kind of tanai, which is called a tanai of im. But we're dealing with a tanai of almanas. And in a tanai of almanas, it means the chalos, the validity is now, but it could be undermined if there's a bitul atanai. So the same thing applies here in the case of Ibra Hashanah. They instituted Ibra Hashanah that would be valid now, but only if the condition of Ad Sheyirtze Rav Gamliel would be fulfilled. Once Rav Gamliel nodded his nod of approval, then l'mafreya retroactively, the Ibra was chal in its time. The reason why I emphasize this, Rabosai, is because the whole motivation here to do this Ibra process in the absence of Rav Gamliel is because of the urgency of the moment. And if you're going to tell me that it would not be achieved until Rav Gamliel would return, so what did they gain over here? They could have waited for Rav Gamliel. The answer is they couldn't wait for Rav Gamliel. They needed desperately the Ibra Hashanah at that moment. So therefore, if you're familiar with the concept of Rotzani, which means that whenever there's a condition that so-and-so will agree, then it's meaningful and it's valid l'mafreya. If you're familiar with that concept, that's exactly what's going on. And now we begin the major sugya here of Ibra Hashanah. What are the reasons and the motivations to justify adding a month to the year? Torah Rabbanan. Ein ma'avrim es Hashanah. Elim kein ha'isa tzricha. There has to be an absolute need. Pressing. And what is that need? Number one. Mipnei hadrachim u'mipnei hagesharim. I read these together as one concept. What we're talking about is too much rain. Now, as we get closer to the spring, the sun starts shining and the rain stops, and things that got wet become dry. But the process of drying will be effective relative to when the sun is going to come out. You know, that's when we're going to get to spring. So we went through the winter months. And what happened was the gsharim, the bridges, and the drachim, and the highways, they were all flooded with so much water. And that would impede transportation. Now there's a critical moment in which transportation has to be up and running. And that's the regel, that's the holiday of Pesach. Why? Because not everyone was located in Yerushalayim. If you were in Yerushalayim, then you'll find your way to the Beis HaMikdash for Aliyah LeRegel. But if you're out there in Nahariya, you know, it's going to take you a long time. How much more so if you're in Bavel, you're in Chutz Laaretz. So what was critical here is that the bridges and the highways be up and running, be functional. And if they were inundated by rains, and there wasn't enough time for these rainwaters to dry, then the Ole Regel would not be able to make it to Yerushalayim. But by adding another month of Adar and postponing Pesach for another month, they would allow for the sun to dry up these inundated roads and bridges. Number two, Mipnei Tanurei Psachim. On Erev Pesach, we have to bring a Karban Pesach. And the Karban Pesach requires what's called Tzli. Tzli means roasting, and you have to roast it in the ovens. Now the ovens were made of earthenware. Earthenware, if it's exposed to the elements, also becomes very wet. And during the winter months, the ovens are almost non-functional. Now this becomes critical when we get to the Erev Pesach for the Korban Pesach. We need those ovens desperately. So in order to achieve that, we need that the ovens dry. If we add another month, because it's a very rainy extended winter, but if we add the month of Adar, then these ovens will dry up, and that will facilitate the roasting of the Korban Pesach. So that too is ample reason to add another month. U'mipnei Golios Yisrael, shenekru mimkomon. We're talking about people who live outside of the land of Israel. They want to come in Aliyah L'Regel as well for Chag HaPesach, and they've already been Nekar B'Mkom. They already have begun their trek to the land of Israel, but Adayin Lo Higiyu. But they haven't yet gotten to Eretz Yisrael, and they're not going to make it on time because things are slowing them down. The winter is very difficult; it's dragging along. And if we add an extra month, that'll give them an extra month to arrive in the Beis Hamikdash for Aliyah L'Regel. Then that too is enough reason to add an extra month. The Mefarshim add here that those who lived in Eretz Yisrael would somehow, even if they were far away from Yerushalayim, they would somehow find a way to Yerushalayim even despite the difficult conditions. And that's what the Brisa continues and says the following: Lo mipnei hasheleg, even if there's lots of snow, people could manage in the snow. Velo mipnei hatzina, even if it's very cold, they'll manage to come in Aliyah despite the cold weather, and therefore we don't find the pressing need to add an extra month in order to get the cold weather behind us or the snowy weather behind us, because they'll find a way of making it in Eretz Yisrael. And if there are Jews in Chutz Lartz that haven't yet begun their trek, even though it might mean that in the normal calendar as it is, without adding a month, they won't make it on time, that's not ample reason to be ma'abra the shon. Tana Rabbanan, the Gemara now brings a brisa to reject other possible reasons, but they're rejected. Ein ma'abra mesashana, lo mipnei agidim, v'lo mipnei atloim. Once again, we're talking about the mitzvah of Korban Pesach. And if you have a large family, okay, let me just add something. Does everybody know what minui is?
Sort of.
Minui, in the case of Korban Pesach, means that you can't eat from this particular lamb unless you are manu. You have to sign up for it. You have to make a kinyan, actually. It's a kinyan of shutfis. So we have X number of partners on the lamb, and then we have to guarantee that everyone gets a good piece of the lamb, right? Everyone wants to, who doesn't want to eat roast lamb, right? So that's the mitzvah of Achilas Korban Pesach. But, unfortunately, if you ask the animal growers, those who raise animals, I don't know what you call them, the animal breeders, whatever. So it turns out that the gdiyim, the goats, and the tloyim, and the lambs that they need for the Korban Pesach have not yet matured. They're very young. And if they're very young, there's not that much meat. So we won't be able to have ample meat to guarantee that everyone at the Seder table, all the Menuyim who are registered on the Korban Pesach, will get a sizable portion of the Korban Pesach. That's not sufficient reason. Even though if we would delay the Korban Pesach by 1 month, by adding an extra month, we would have fatter Gdiyim, and fatter Tloyim, and we would have more meat to give out to Korban Pesach. But nevertheless, this brisa reflects the view that the minimum amount of meat that you have to eat at the Korban Pesach is one kezias. Anything beyond that is just a tosefes mitzvah. So that even if the gdiei izim and tloim are very meager in size, they're very young, nevertheless, we'll be able to offer that kezias for every one of the menuyim. And therefore we don't have to fatten them up by delaying the Korban Pesach by a month. Okay, now there's a tosus here, Dibra Maskel Mipnei. There are actually two tosus in by that name. The one that interests us the most is the first tosus. And here's the deal. Let me try to explain to you what bothers tosus. On Daf Yud Aleph Amid Beis, there's going to be another brisa that addresses the motivating or urgent reasons that would lead to the decision of Bima Abra the Shana. And the brisa is going to delineate three reasons. none of those appear here in the Braisa that we've been studying. Again, we had two Braisas. The first Braisa told us that the positive reasons for Ibur, you remember the roads were inundated, the people in Chutzarts were on the way, the ovens were still drying, they were still wet. And then the second Braisa was the reasons why we don't have ample reason to be Ma'abar the Shana. But nowhere in these Braisos is there mention of the three most powerful reasons, which will appear in the Braisa on Daf Yud Aleph on the days, for Ibur Shana, which are called Aviv, Tkufa, and Peros HaIlon. I mean, two out of the three I can explain to you pretty simply. Aviv means we have to make sure that the spring coincides with the month of Nisan, and that the grains are already growing in the field at the time of Nisan. If it's too early in the season, then you have a problem. Peros HaIlon means a little bit later on. We're talking about Chag HaShavuos now, and on Chag HaShavuos we have a mitzvah bikurim, which comes from the fruits, and the fruits are not growing yet. It's still winter, so we have to add another month. And then there's something called Tkufa. Okay, so Tkufa we're not going to discuss right this second. Well, maybe we'll leave that for tomorrow. That's this piece. Anybody wants to take a copy? If not, I'll give it out tomorrow. Exactly what Tkufa is all about. But in any event, these three major, major pillars of Ibur Shana, the causes for Ibur Shana, are not mentioned here in our Braisa. So what's going on? How do we reconcile our Braisa, which talks about the roads and the people who are on the way and the ovens and all that? How do we reconcile that with the Braisa on Amud Beis, which mentions Aviv, Tkufa, and Peros HaIlon? So Tosa says the following. That our Braisa is listing three reasons for Ibur Shana, each one of which, in and of itself, will justify Ibur Shana. Was that clear? So, for example, when you have this box that has three check boxes, it's got Drachim, it's got Tanurim, it's got Golios, how many of those boxes do you have to check off in order to move forward with Ibur Shana? Only one. Clear? Now, in the case of the Braisa on Daf Yud Aleph Amud Beis, which is Aviv, Tkufa, and Peros HaIlon, there we have to check off minimum of two out of three of the boxes. If you have one and only one, that's not sufficient justification for Ibur Shana. Again, why that's so, we'll get to Emirtz Hashem in the Sugya and Daf Yud Beis. So it's very interesting that our Braisa really reflects that which is critical, and any one of these three elements are so critical that in and of themselves independently, they can justify Ibur Shana. That is the Shita of Tosfos. Rabbeinu Yonah, on the other hand, has a different Shita. He says the following. That there are two categories of reasons for Ibur Shana. One category is called Doraisa, and the other category is called Dirabanan. As far as the Doraisa is concerned, the Torah is concerned, there are three reasons, and only three reasons, for being Mi'abra the Shana. And that's called Aviv, Tkufa, and Peros HaIlon. The other reasons, which are Drachim, Gisharim, Tanurim, and the Bnei Agola, that is a decision of the rabbis in any particular generation, because the Torah doesn't specify those reasons. So when the Braisa here says that for Drachim, etc., Ein Bezdin Ma'abrim Es Hashana Midaitam Ela Al HaDrachim VaGesharim, in other words, here the guidance is totally dependent upon the initiative and the decision of the Beis Din. So it's very interesting, Rabbi Yonah, when he reads our Braisa that says, Ein Ma'abrin Es Hashana Ela Im Kain, etc., Drachim, Gsharim, Tanurim, he adds one word to the Braisa. Ein Ma'abrin Es Hashana Midatam Ela, etc. In other words, even though the Torah allows authority to the Rabbanon, to the Bezdin in every generation, in any generation, to be Ma'abed Hashana when they see it fit, but these are the guidelines. And beyond these guidelines, there's no license to the Chachamim to make a decision on their own to be Ma'abed Hashana. The other Braisa is going to deal with the Doraisa on the Torah level. That's the way Rabbeinu Yonah learns it. There are three reasons which are called Aviv, Tkufa, and Perosa Ilan. It's Kedai to memorize those three. We're going to have it over and over again. That justify Ibur Hashanah. Now, we spoke about these little lambs, you know, Mary had a little lamb, and it's very small, and we say that's not a justification to add a month. Now we're going to talk about gozlos. V'lom ibnei ha-gozlos shelo pirchu. Now the word gozlos, which means birds, in this particular context, is a generic term that includes two specific category or species of birds. And they are called Torim and Bnei Yonah. Now there's an entire Masechet in Shas that's dedicated to these two species of birds. Oh, that Masechet is only Mishnais, there's no Bavli. And that's called Masechet Kinim. Kinim means a nest. Now if a person contracts Tumas Zav, that means he has a Ziva from his organ, or in the case of a woman, she's a Zava, or a woman after birth, she has to bring a kan, which means a nest, of Torim and Bnei Yonah. Now, what are the ages of these birds, which are called pigeons and doves? So there's a fundamental difference between the two. And that is about the first birthday that they celebrate, so to speak. Now, I forget which is which right now. Let me just think if I remember. I need the Hebrew here, if you don't mind. Yeah, give it to me in Hebrew, because otherwise I'll get all confused. I think in the case of Torim, a Tor has to be Ben Shana, correct? It has to be at least 1 year. In the case of Bnei Yonah, it could be even less. It has to be less than a year. So in any event, the halacha here is that if she cannot bring both Torim and Bnei Yonah, then b'dieved, this Yoledes can bring one of the two species. So therefore, if we're worried about the fact that there's not ample access to both of these two species, but one of the two, there certainly will be. Do you follow? You know, they both develop at the same rate, just that one was born before the other. So if you're talking about the first birthday, if one has passed the first birthday and therefore cannot be used, then the other one is within its first birthday and it can be used. So she can always substitute one for the other. So instead of bringing Torim, she could bring Bnei Yonah or the reverse. So that's not ample reason to be Ma'abra the Shana. Nevertheless, the Brisa points out that although these pressing reasons are not critical enough to justify Ibur Shana, Aval Osim Oso Sa'ad Lishana. The word Sa'ad literally translates as an addition, a support. And we're going to use it as support, meaning if there are other reasons that would push us, you know, towards the decision of Ibur Shana, but we haven't yet, you know, crossed over the actual the line of decision, then we can add these factors, these elements into the equation, and that will push us over the precipice. Ketzad. So the Gemara wants to know what would be an example where we use these reasonings not to justify Ibur Shana, but as a sa'ad, if we have other reasons, we'll add this into the cholent, and the weight, and it'll tip the scale. Rav Yani Omer Mishum Rav Shimon Gamliel. So now Rav Yani says in the name of Rav Shimon Gamliel. Now what we're about to embark upon is a document which was sent out to the people of Israel, notifying them not only of the Ibrish, the decision to be Ma'abra the Shana, but the reason why they were Ma'abra the Shana. So the document begins with the words Mehodi'im Anachnu Lachem, which is very similar to Hebrew. Mehodi'im Anachnu Lachem. In other words, with this document, we are notifying you. Degozalya Rachichin, that some of those birds, let's say the turtles, the turtle doves, are still too young. V'imraya de Daadkin, Imraya are these little lambs. Daadkin are very thin, meaning they're not lean. They're still lean and they're not fat yet, so they won't give us enough for the Korban Pesach. V'zimna de Aviva lo mata, and we're up to Chodesh Nisan, which is around the corner. Not exactly there yet, but we're up to it, and we're in Adar. And guess what? The Aviv, the spring, has not yet come. So that means that the produce in the land is not reaching its full development, its maturity. The Ushfaris Milsaban Paya, therefore, it appeals to our face, meaning to our decision making, that the Osifis al Shata Da Tlasin, we're going to add to this year an extra 30 days of Chodesh Adar. Now notice that one of the most pressing reasons was Aviv, right? We have to guarantee that Pesach falls out in the Aviv. But that alone would not be sufficient, because that belongs to the next Braisa, where you need two out of three. And the answer is that Rav Shimon Gamliel is going to make a decision, even though he only has one out of the three, because he adds a sad from two other reasons, which have to do with Korban Pesach and the kinim of Zavra Zava, or Yoledes, which in and of themselves would not be sufficient, but when they add them to the reasoning of Chodesh of the Aviv, that's going to tip the scale. So what we have here is one reason, which in and of itself is a major reason, but we need a second, and what we're going to do is we're going to take these minor reasons and we're going to add that, and therefore we're going to make a decision to add an extra month. Now, how many days does that extra month have?
30.
That's not clear at all. 30. In fact, we're going to soon see that this Rav Gamliel himself, this Rav Shimon Gamliel himself, says that you have to add a month of 31 days. And that's the sugi we want to cover tomorrow. How do we reconcile these two statements of Rav Shimon Gamliel? Are we going to add a month of Adar which has 30 days, or a month of Adar which has 31 days? That's what we're going to cover in Mirtz Hashem, in Mirtz Hashem B'li Neder tomorrow. Okay then? So again, we're moving slowly, but we're making some progress to try to understand the reasoning that would compel the Beis Din to make that decision. This is at the time when there was a Beis Din HaGadol Kavua in Yerushalayim, before the Churban of Eretz Yisrael. This is before the calendar. What would move the Beis Din to make that decision? And we'll continue with that in Mirtz Hashem tomorrow. Of the Sad?
Without the Sad. So you could have a Pesach that's not in...
I think I'll be smarter to answer your question tomorrow when we understand why the Gemara says we need two out of three. And it's going to be a machlokas whether Aviv is included in the two out of three. And then we'll have to go back to our Gemara here on Amin Aleph and figure out why they needed a side in the case of Aviv.
Whether you could ever have a Pesach that's not in Aviv.
Right.
We do have a Pesach that's not in Aviv. That does come out.
Okay. So maybe you'll help us out with that tomorrow. I made a note here. Oh, this is it. Shekeinah Torim. Oh, you remember I was asking which one of the two Torim of Bnei Yonah are younger than a year or older than a year. So I have it written here in a footnote.
You're going to see Elana and
Torim.
You're going to see Elana and
Sherim LeKarbon Rak Kshehem Gedolim, meaning after the year. Bnei Yonah Kshehem Rak Kshehem Ketanim. But in Monashach, we're going to get either Bnei Yonah or Torim. Then I have another note here, which I guess we'll leave for tomorrow. Ma'avras Hashana imatfuah lo tispashu kol tzakat haPesach in Paris Eilam Fine Kedat Kufa Mishal Pitamech Ma'avras Hashana al Shnayim Liyin Zeh Osa Tzlam Gol Sash Mitzar from Hain Fine. That we said you go to Matvulo to special called Tzorkar Pesach. Is then Ma'abrim Aleim is such a fine. So that we covered. I can check this one.
The Bnei Yonah turns into a tor.
No, I think they're two different species, as far as I know. One is called a dove, one's a pigeon. I think you can get pictures of it. I have a book somewhere on Kochin that has pictures.
Mr. Gamora said that one turns yellow or something.